Our next speaker I met out in a Lynbrook Primary Purpose Group. When I first got sober, I had never really been to a Big Book meeting at all in my life. And we walked in there. I remember being at first very intimidated by a lot of the people in Lynbrook. And then I realized, you know, they pretty much carry the 12-step the best I've ever seen. When I walked in and Barb was doing the Big Book studies, something about him was just like, wow. And, you know, a few of us got our foundation in that meeting, and we started there. And, it was a great experience, and I'm glad I met a lot of the people out there. And with that, leave it to Barb.
Hi, my name is Bart, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. And, my sober date is June 12th, 1995. And, we look ahead at people who've been sober longer than us, and Miriam has been sober a little longer. If you do get up, I will take it personally, so please don't get up. My home group is the Lynbrook Primary Purpose Group, and congratulations to this Primary Purpose Group. 1 year, a lot of active members I see, and you know, a lot of people getting better here, and that's what it's all about. You know, so to celebrate that is an amazing thing. That there's a room down here that people are coming to for a year and recovering from a thing, a horrible thing called alcoholism, that most people die from. You know, and then because of this room and the power that's in this room, right, Derek? People are living great, sober lives. We recover from this, you know, and I use that word a lot. Our Big Book uses that word a lot. And I introduced myself as a recovered member of Alcoholics Anonymous for two important reasons to me. The first reason is I saw some new people here tonight, and that's why we stand up here and share our experience, strength, and hope, to give you hope if you're new. And to tell you that you can't recover from alcoholism, that you just got to try to stay sober a day at a time, that doesn't sound very hopeful. But that's not what AA is. You can recover from alcoholism. Our 12th step says, having had a spiritual awakening, and that's what we're here for, a spiritual awakening, and as a result of that spiritual awakening, we recover from alcoholism. That's the byproduct of it. So I hope that gives you some hope. The other reason that I do it is a little bit of a selfish reason for myself. I came in 1987. My sober date is June 12th, 1995, which is also, like Miriam, a made-up date. I got so tired of trying to remember my sober date because I kept relapsing. So I think it's June 12th, but it's definitely 1995. I wasn't that bad. Another year. When I came in 1987... there's something that we read in practically every meeting in how it works. It says, those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Well, from 87 to 95, I wouldn't. So I couldn't. You know, in 95, I would. So I did. It's just that simple. Now, this program is so simple. I had a great experience here tonight. You know, I came here, I came into the room, and somebody said, you know, I did a lot of work here, and I got something here that you really like, and I think you should try it. And, you know, contempt prior investigation, I don't like that shit. Never tried it, but I don't like it. And that's what we do when we get here. I don't like God stuff, and it's making amends, and you know, I don't like that. And, if you give it a shot, you know, it's real easy, and he showed me how to do this, and I did it, and you know what? It was the best thing I ever ate, an artichoke. That's what we do here. We just pass on a message. And I never ate one, and now I got something that I love, and thanks for the hard work of cooking and everybody else that cooked, you know? But that's just what we do. We try something, we do it, we pass it on, and somebody else gets it and loves it. You know, and that's what happened here. You know, somebody came here, tried something, passed it on in a loving way to me, kind of a loving way, and I'll talk about that, and passed it on to me, and that's all I try to do. So first I'll tell you a little bit about myself. my heroes growing up. I grew up in apartment buildings in Queens, New York, and looking out the apartment buildings, there were the older kids, the older guys, girls, standing on the corner, getting drunk, getting loaded, getting high. And whew, man, I just wanted to go downstairs and hang out with them and do what they were doing and be just like them. My upstairs neighbor, the guy that lived right upstairs from me, Roger, died of a heroin overdose, and he was my hero. And what was wrong with my thinking? I don't know. But I wanted to be just like these people. You know, I loved the action that they seemed to be having. And it wasn't long before I was the young guy hanging out with them and drinking and hanging out with them and doing all sorts of stuff. And it was very difficult for me growing up to make friends. I was very shy. I still am. This isn't easy. This is, God, I'm doing this for you, to help somebody else. Because if I didn't say that before I got up here, then my heart would be pounding, and I couldn't do it. So I started hanging out with these people, and still didn't really feel like I fit in. But I was feeling okay. Drinking made me feel at least comfortable. You know, that's not necessarily alcoholism or something like a prerequisite for alcoholism is being shy, because I know tons of people who are very outgoing and are still alcoholic. You know, it's just our personalities, and no matter what personality you are, no matter what race, religion, no matter what anything, and our big book describes it, you know, psychopath, not a psychopath. Doesn't matter what you are, you can still be an alcoholic. Well, I was a shy one, and alcohol worked a little bit. And alcohol started to really take on my life. It really helped me get through life. And by fifth grade, I really enjoyed hanging out in the school park instead of going into school with the guys that were outside dealing some kind of drugs, but they were drinking while they were doing it, and I was drinking with them instead of going into school. And of course, obviously, I wasn't going in enough for my grades to hold up, and I was starting to get in some trouble, so they were going to leave me back in fifth grade. And my parents were moving to another neighborhood, not too far, and it was a matter of changing schools, so they had one of the first big meetings that was going to be of hundreds about me in school, and they convinced them that, you know, I just fell into the wrong groups, and they'll give me a chance and promote me, and so they did, and I spent that entire summer riding my bicycle back to the old neighborhood and learning how to drink more and, you know, and enjoying the summer. And I met no friends in the new neighborhood because that would have been too hard. You know, it was easier just to get on my bicycle and try to make it home on my bicycle pretty drunk every day. The first day of school came, and I was scared to death. You know, I got to meet new teachers and new kids, and I didn't know what to do until I figured out if I go into my parents' closet and I drink, then I'll feel at least a little more comfortable to go to school. So that's what I did, and it worked. So if it worked the first day, it'll definitely work the second day. If it worked the second day, it'll definitely work the third day. So it became, that's how I went to school every day. And I met kids that were doing the same thing, or, you know, drinking behind the handball courts and smoking weed. And so those are the people I started to hang out with, and I started to get into a lot of trouble in this school. And there was a woman who came from another school called Project 25, and it was a drug and alcohol program. And once a week, the kids that were getting in trouble for alcohol or drugs in this school would have to go into this room and spend some time with her and talk to her. So that was me. So I'd have to go talk to this woman. I remember her, Josie. And it's amazing how something, like, I haven't remembered her name in years, and it just popped in. So I'd go sit with her, and I was still always getting into trouble. And she said to me one day, you know, they don't want you in this school anymore. And if you continue to get caught drunk or alcohol in your locker here, then they're going to sign you out of this school, and you're going to have to come full-time to Project 25. And that was a huge threat to me, because the only thing I could think of is, shit, now I got to meet new friends. You know, I don't want to do that. But I didn't want to quit drinking either, because I loved drinking. So I figured I'd just get away with it, and I kept drinking. And before I knew it, I was going to Project 25. Project 25 got a little rough, because they started really educating my parents on all the stuff I was doing. And I started to get real angry about it, because alcohol was working for me, and my parents had split up. And I came from a nice home. And my mother used to start getting really scared about my behaviors, because I would disappear for days at a time because I wanted a drink. So I would sleep in the elevator shafts of the buildings so that I could drink. I would sleep in friends' closets, garages. There were some houses nearby that had garages. I would go to any length to be able to get drunk and not hear my mother's, you know, shit about it. My mother started to get really scared, and I had a sister who died very young, and my mother was 120 pounds soaking wet, and she was standing in front of the front door crying hysterical, "Please, I don't want to lose another child. Can't watch you kill yourself. You need to stop this." And I would pick her up and throw her away from the door and go out and do what I wanted to do for as long as the cycle ran, and then come home. Sometimes a bloody mess. Sometimes I wouldn't come home, but there would be a phone call. His son is locked up in the 109th precinct, and so on and so forth. But I started to get into a whole lot of trouble. There were PINS petitions, person in need of supervision. I started going into shelters in Brooklyn, sneaking out the windows of the shelters and drinking with night train with the bums on the corner. I went to any length to drink, you know, because I loved to drink. Started spending some weeks in Spofford, places in Staten Island, Geller House, all kinds of institutions, all because I wanted a drink. And every place I went to, and every psychiatrist that my parents would send me to, all told me the same thing. And every judge told me the same thing. "You seem like such a nice boy. If you just didn't drink, you wouldn't get into this trouble, and you'd be okay." And that had absolutely no depth and weight, because the only thing that went through my head is, "No, you don't understand. The only time I'm okay is when I drink." You know, that was the only answer that I had for myself. So I kept drinking. Well, 18 months in Hawthorne, and I started to say to myself, maybe there's something to this drinking. You know, maybe I should stop drinking as much as I'm drinking. Maybe I should just drink on the weekends, you know, and not get in so much trouble. You know, and it was very difficult. My drinking wasn't exactly fun. You know, like I said, it was hard for me to make friends. Well, I always drank more than everybody else. You know, we went to Fort Totten to have a cake party, and everybody made it home, and I did all kinds of stupid things, or started fights, or woke up at Fort Totten in the morning, and the kids made fun of me the next day. Now, I still didn't fit in even when I was drinking, because of the stupid things I did, because of the amount that I drank. Anyway, so while I was at Hawthorne, I decided that I was going to not drink so much anymore. And I came home from Hawthorne, and I went to the high school for the first day. And now this is years of being in and out of institutions. And, you know, I went into the dean's office the first day of school, you know, because they called me in there, and they took out my records, and they said, "What? We don't want your trouble here. We're going to be watching you. If you get in any trouble in our school," like they're all saints there, "but if you get into any trouble in our school, you're out." Well, I still had an attitude, and I said, "You know what?" I got up, and I went home, and I called my father, who's a successful businessman, and I said, "Look, Dad, and I hadn't spoken to my father in quite some time. I really didn't like my parents at this time. My mother was lock him up, he's an animal, and my father was, your mother's got custody, there's really nothing I could do." You know, so it was all their fault, all these places that I went to. I had nothing to do with it. It was all their fault. But I humbled myself, and I called my father, and I said, "Look, can you sign me out of school, and can I come work for you?" And he said he would think about it. He would discuss it with his partners, and he'd get back to me. And they called me back. I guess they discussed it with my mother, and they decided that it was a good idea. I was going nowhere in school anyway, and they'll teach me the business, and maybe something will come of me, you know? So the first day of school was a cold October morning, not the October that we have now, and it was the week of my birthday. And I was standing at the bus stop, and I was waiting for the bus, and I was all excited, you know? I'm going to make my family proud. I'm going to do the right thing. Turning over a new leaf. This is going to be great. You know, I'm going to be a working man. And you know, all my friends were going to school, and I'm the working man. And what a great thing. And one of my friends came over and gave me a little birthday present, a little bottle of Jack Daniels. And I put it in my coat. And I said, this weekend I'll celebrate that I'm a working man and my birthday, you know. So I put it in my coat and I'm waiting for the bus, and it started getting cold out. Well, we all know what Jack Daniels will do, a little slug and you'll warm up. So I took a little slug to warm up, and now I'm sitting on the bus and I'm getting a little nervous, first day of work. I know how to calm my nerves. Jack Daniels. Well, I finished that bottle, got off the bus, walked into work for the first day, and I knew exactly how to run the business and made it no shit. And I made a complete ass of myself and my father. Well, that wasn't my intention that morning. My intention was to not drink and do the right thing. All the other times that I drank because I wanted to drink and I loved it. This was the first time in my life that I drank and I didn't want to. I chose not to drink and did anyway. That must be the day I lost the power of choice, because you know what? I was never able to make the right decision again. For years, I went on drinking because I wanted to, trying to stop, checking myself in and out of, you know, outpatient programs, stumbling my way in, couldn't even have the $5 in the sliding scale to pay the psychiatrist or the social worker for the program I was in. But I was stumbling in, and every one of them would say, you know what? You've never paid us a penny. We're only asking for $5. And you walk in here drunk or high as a kite. You got to go. And then I would just go about my way, and then until I hit another whatever where I couldn't take it anymore, and try to go to another outpatient. And this went on for years. And the troubles got worse. And, you know, like Miriam said, you know, we don't talk about those stories from the podium. One-on-one, you want to talk about it? You know, that's the place. That's 12-step work. That, you know, I'll tell you all the stories that went on, you know, the things that I did, the morals of my own that I broke. You know, breaking everybody else's morals is no big deal, but the things that go on, like, I'll never do that until I did that. But I'll never do that until I did that. You know, those stories we can talk all about one-on-one. 1987. I was hanging out in a house that was owned by three brothers in Queens Village. There wasn't a civilian that walked past the front of that house. Any one person can go on a round trip to Hawaii on probably one day of our empties. We all own motorcycles, and none of them ever left the garage. I was married to my first wife, and if anybody ever called and asked if I was there, the answer was, no, he's probably over at Heroin Haven, or she probably had some kind of name for it, but it wasn't like she's over at, you know, their house. And one of the guys, one of the brothers that owned the house that was always hanging out with me, I mean, as a matter of fact, I was in a bad motorcycle accident, and he used to pick me up in the morning and bring me to this house and drink with me early in the morning before everybody else showed up. And he wasn't sitting down with us and drinking anymore. He was showing up with this new guy, this new friend. And they were going into the garage, and they were kickstarting the bike, and they were taking off. And one day I went up to him and I said, hey, Warren, where are you going? Oh, you know, I met this guy, Mike, and joined this AA, and I quit drinking, and my life is so much better now. And that's nice. I went back and continued to drink. And every once in a while, I'd ask him more about where he was going. And 1987, after New Year's, and getting into all kinds of trouble, I called Warren and I said, can you take me to one of those meetings, because I'm dying. And Warren said, I'm not going to a meeting tonight, but I'll tell you where there's a meeting. And they'll know you're new and they'll make you feel comfortable. Just go to this address, and he told me how to get there, and it's in a school, and you'll be all right. So I sweated out all day, and I was a mess. And I showed up to this school, and I was walking around the school looking for, like, how the hell am I going to find out how to get into this school? And I was just about ready to give up, probably, and a guy came over to me, and he said, you're looking for the AA meeting? And I said, yeah. And he said, come with me, I'm setting it up. So I said, all right. So I followed him in, and he started going into the locker and taking all the stuff out and laying stuff out. And he hands me this blue card, and he says, hey, you want to read this? Sure. And I sat down, and I read that. And I read that, and I didn't have to look at any of you walking in the room because I had something to focus on, because I couldn't look at any of you. So I just kept sitting there and reading it. And he opened up the meeting, and then he went, and to read blue card, we have Bart. And my heart jumped right out of my toes. I did not know that he meant read it out loud. Well, that was the end of AA for me in my head. I sat there for what felt like 5 hours, but was probably less than 5 minutes, figuring out how am I getting out of this room with nobody seeing me, because this shit ain't for me. And I snuck out of the room. And I got lost in the school. And now I swore I'm going to jail, because I did not look like you people. They weren't going to believe I was an AA. I was in there to rob the school, because I looked like I needed it, everything that was in the school. I found my way back to the classroom that they were in, and I leaned up outside of the room on the wall. And I said, all right, the meeting can't be that long. I'll just follow them out of the school, and then I'll go get drunk. Well, your meeting ended, and you guys surrounded me, and you kidnapped me back to the diner. You wouldn't let me go home. And I was scared to death. But you guys loved me so much, and you just kept telling me it was going to be okay. And I didn't listen to anything other than, you guys ride motorcycles and you're sober, and it all sounded good. But I was still real shy and still scared to death, and I wasn't really sure that I wanted to stop drinking, and I still had a bad attitude, and some of you would offer me $20 to raise my hand to just say my name. I know now people offer me $100 to shut up, but then I wouldn't even take the $20 to raise my hand. 8 years around AA, almost 8 years, I never even raised my hand to say my name. I'd grab you on the side and tell you how miserable I was and that I wanted to die. I would never raise my hand and share it, because my attitude was, you know what? My problems are none of your business, and I'm not really interested in yours. So most of the time you found me outside smoking cigarettes outside the meeting rather than sitting in the meeting listening to how you people were getting better. 1995 or so, sometime, one of those, not a cloud on the horizon, the end of a perfect day, a buddy of mine called me up and he said, Bart, I'm dying. And this is a guy that I got sober with, you know, and he had relapsed, and he says, I need to go to detox. I'll be right there. Well, I went and picked him up. He went into a little neighborhood that I took him to so he could fix himself up before he went into the hospital, and I reached into my pocket, took out a $100 bill, and I said, hey, you want to get me some too? Woke up the next morning. What the hell did I do yesterday? Almost 8 years. I just threw it down the tubes. You know? Now, I wasn't sure if I wanted to live for a long time. You know, I was becoming more and more suicidal. But now I was really sure, because that shit didn't work anymore. And neither was staying sober. And I didn't know what to do. But I knew that that didn't work, and I was never going to do that again. So I called up my boss, and I said, I need an easy day of work today, because I'm not feeling too good. And he gave it to me. And I went to bed that night. And I woke up the next morning and I said, you know what? 2 days ago wasn't so bad. And there I went again. And that lasted for, I don't know, till approximately June 12th. I don't know how long. But I know that on that day, I went into a neighborhood and I started a fight with some people. I was messed up and I started a fight with some people that I had no business starting a fight with. And I was lucky they didn't cut me up and throw me into a dumpster. And I was in a complete rage of anger. And I came out of that rage and I was back in a room sitting with you people. And I don't remember driving there. But that's where I was. And I was in this room, in this meeting that they called the Utopia Young People's Meeting. And there was all these young people, and they were loving life. And they were laughing. And they were talking about God. And they were going to the city after the meeting every night, and going into clubs where music was playing, and people were drinking, and people were having fun. And I was really uncomfortable, because all the years that I was so dry, I couldn't go to those places. You know, I'd go with friends or my wife, and we'd go to a bar or a club. It wouldn't be long before I'd say, we got to get out of here. I'm really uncomfortable. I can't be around this shit. So these young people were going and having fun and dancing and going into the mosh pits and all kinds of crazy shit. And I was like, they're not uncomfortable. They must not be as alcoholic as I am. That was my answer. But they started, you know, they were telling me stories about shit that they did. They were just as alcoholic as I was. This one guy, Artie, was celebrating his 1 year anniversary at the Utopia Group. And I went that night. And I was sitting right next to Artie, and the sponsor was hysterical. He was laying on the floor, reaching his hand to the phone, like, you know, pretending he was reaching the phone, dialing 911, just really animated about telling what it was like. And I was cracking up and really enjoying the way that he was telling his story. And then he started to get real serious about God and going where anybody else can go without any danger and being recovered and, you know, just talking about being happy, joyous, free. And I was getting really irritated. And I turned around to Artie and I said, Artie, that's your sponsor speaking up there, right? And he said, yeah. And I said, I think tonight you should find a new one. And he said, why? And I said, because I'm going to kill him. And I meant it. I absolutely meant it, because he had no right to talk about being that happy and not drinking. That's bullshit. He was lying. You know, he had no right to sit there and lie in front of so many people. And Artie had a great answer. He said, I'm sure I'd love to talk to you. And they set it up for the next day. You know, he had owned a store, a recovery store, you know, books and coins. And he said, go over to his store, and I'm going to tell him you're going to come and talk to him. So I did. And, it was a very fun conversation for about 2 hours. All I had to do was step forward once, and he'd step back twice. You know, he was scared to death. But during that 2 hours, about 2 hours, he continued to talk about his alcoholism and himself as an alcoholic. And every once in a while, he'd throw out how, you know, glad he is he doesn't have to live like that anymore. And after about 2 hours, I finally said, what do I got to do to have that? Because I knew he was once just like me. You know, after listening to him for so long, talking about it. And he said, I'm glad you finally asked. And now he wasn't running anymore. He was more towards me, because he knew he had me. Because now I didn't want to kill him, I wanted what he had. And he told me that if I read that big book, and if I followed all the directions in it and practiced it for the rest of my life, that I'd have a great life. Well, I had a good answer for that one. Well, Eric, I never read a book in my life. And from what I hear, that one's pretty boring, written in old language. I never looked at it, but that's what I heard you people say. So I copied it and said, so I can't do that. He grabbed me at the shoulder and he said, not so fast. I'll tell you what, I'll read it to you. He says, but in the beginning of the book, it's going to talk about alcoholism. And it's going to talk about some things about alcoholism. If you identify to them, let's talk about it. And I'll talk about what I identify to. And I said, cool. He says, then we're going to get to a point that you're going to know nothing about. And he says, that's the point where the only stupid question is the one you don't ask. He said, just ask a lot of questions and be willing to practice it, to experience it. See, Artie was the kind of guy who Audie was his first sponsee, and Audie was full of confidence. He wasn't one of those shy guys. Audie was a bartender that flipped the bottles around and, you know, in all the fancy bars, and he was still a bartender, even in sobriety, and he was, you know, his ass was on the back of the chair, his feet were on the front, and he talked real proud, and he had a college degree, and he was a school teacher besides a bartender, and I was a guy who had a fifth grade education, and you know, and socially retarded. I didn't know how to talk to people. I was scared to death of you. And so I said, you know, I'm not going to get it like Audie got it. You know, he's got all that going on, and like, I don't. And Audie got a resentment, and Eric laughed. And he said, Bart, you know how you drove your car here today? And I said, yeah. He says, describe what you did. I said, I really can't. He said, well, it's the same thing with this program. It's a design for living. Just keep practicing it, and it'll become a way of life. And you won't be able to describe it. You'll just be able, no more than describing what a rose smells like. But you will be able to help people through this book and so on and so forth. And so we started to read it, you know, and that doctor's opinion started to make a whole lot of sense, you know. It wasn't the first drink that got you drunk. Because, you know, they say, don't pick up the first one, you won't get drunk. And I thought, oh, well, you can't go right to the second one, you know. Well, now I understood. So I thought I got the answer now. I got this physical allergy, so I just don't pick up the first one. Then we started to talk about more about alcoholism, and there is a solution. The alcoholic mind, not being able to play back the old tapes, losing the power of choice, and going into my history and how many times did people tell me not to do it? How many consequences? How many morals did I break? How many reasons did I have? How many mornings did I wake up and say, I can't drink today, I'm going to die, and did it anyway? Uh-oh, I had the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I didn't feel too good anymore. I had about 1% hope left. Sitting with Eric, read those chapters, it was gone. I was feeling hopeless. That book did its job. That man helped it do its job. I knew I was hopeless. The thing that keeps me sober, especially this past couple of weeks, is the second step, proposition. God either is or he isn't. What's your choice to be? Well, I knew I was totally powerless. And that if I didn't say that there is a God, then I was going to die. You know? And with that, we moved on to that third step decision. The most important decision that I made in my entire life, I'm positive that every single person sitting in this room and every other radio room around the world makes a third step decision. To turn our will and our life, our thoughts and our actions over to the care of God as we understand Him, and if it works, bear witness to others that it works. You know, through our own life. You know, and that's the most important decision I ever made. And it wasn't an easy one, because God, as I understood him, was I don't. Because I didn't believe there was a God. I was the kind of guy who, if I can't see it, I can't touch it, I can't smell it, so on. So all them five senses, well, then it ain't so. And I never did any of that, so it wasn't so. And I didn't believe in any God or any higher power. But I didn't want to die either. So God, as I understand him, is I don't. And that's where I started. Truth of the matter is, you know, we're a little over 12 years sober in the last couple of weeks. I think the last couple of weeks I understand them less today than I did when I first started. But I absolutely know that God exists. I absolutely know that I wouldn't be sober today if there was no God. I absolutely know that if I don't serve God on a daily basis, you know, through my life, with you people I meet in the street at work, much more important demonstration of our principles at home, at work, then I won't be sober. You know, so maybe I really don't have to understand it, and that's okay. You know, if I start thinking I have to understand it, I'm in a whole lot of trouble. I did that in early recovery. You know, I started like a cat chasing his tail. I need to know everything about God. I need to understand God. Well, if God is everything, I'm never going to understand him completely. So I'm okay with where I'm at right now. That was the most important decision. We said that prayer. I said, you know what? If this really works, you're damn right I'll bear witness to people that it works, because I don't believe it's gonna. So if it does, I will. And he handed me a pen and just told me to start writing. Wrote that inventory out, shared it with him, was absolutely willing to let all those things that stood in the way of my usefulness to God and the people around me take it away. because I'm dying, and I was still dying. We beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Thank God I was still at the very start, because I wouldn't have done that, you know, because I didn't do it the first time, because I waited. You know, I waited, and my ego built up, and I don't got to do this shit. I'm miserable, but I ain't drinking, so I ain't got to do that step shit, you know. I was hopeless. I was willing to do it, so I was doing it. Shared it with them, and started making some amazing amends, you know. Some of those amends are the best parts of my stories. You know, some people were very, you know, just stay the fuck away from me, you know. And some were really good. I mean, you know, there were some old friends that I went to, some people I hadn't seen in years, that when I went to make the amends, it was, don't worry about it. Just knowing that you're alive and you're not in prison for the rest of your life is amends enough. I could sleep at peace tonight knowing that, because every once in a while, after all these years, I still wonder. I wonder whatever happened to the Bart, and I don't have to wonder that anymore. You know, so that's what this whole amends process is about. I got 3 and 8. You know, those 9-step promises are great, but they came true for me in 8. For me, I watched the 9-step promises come true in their lives when I went out there. That was my experience. It may be a little different for every one of us, but that was my experience. 10-step is a wonderful thing, you know. I have a lot less fights and arguments with family, friends, bosses, because of that 10-step. Pause when agitated or doubtful. Ask God for the right thought or direction. You know, sometimes my best prayer in the middle of I'm about to curse you out, God, and it stops. I don't have to be right. You know, sometimes it's just that simple. You know, that 10-step is amazing. But I don't always do it perfect, so thank God there's 11. I could review at night and see where we screw up. You know, plan our day, get centered in the morning, plug in. You know, that's what it's all about. Plug in the morning, just bring into your consciousness however you want. Some people have all kinds of rituals, some people roll right to their knees. Whatever it is, as long as you're plugged in, as long as you know that your day is going to be with your higher power, then your chances of having a good day are great. And if you're having a good day, God-centered, then good chance you're not going to pick up a drink. 12-step. Amazing step. You know, my heroes growing up were, you know, those guys I looked out the window. Today, my heroes are my sponsor, Eric, who, you know, he was diabetic and losing part of his foot. He was on kidney dialysis 3 times a week, bedridden, wheelchair bound, still reading that book for people who are dying. So the day he went into a coma and then died, he carried the message to others, you know, with passion. My friend Don Fritz, who carried this message all around the world, and to the day before he died, sat in front of people barely able to breathe, carrying this message. That's the passion that I want. You know, to watch this stuff, you know, grow up. I remember there's a few people in this room that probably remember it too. I like telling this story. It always gives newcomers hope and gives an idea what this program's about. Eric was real sick, and Eric had the biggest ego in the world, and there wasn't a pin big enough to pop his ego. So there was a new group, and you know, he wouldn't celebrate his own anniversary because he was too sick to do that. But there was a new group, just like this one. They were celebrating a year anniversary, they told him. And they said, Eric, we need you to speak for the 1 year anniversary of this group. Yeah, they want me? No problem, I'll be there. Just, if you can wheel me down the stairs. So he got there, and there was a lot of people there that he didn't know went to the group, because we didn't. Like, I wasn't a part of that group, and there was a lot of other people that were there that weren't part of that group. And it was for his anniversary. And they had myself and 2 other people speak for him at his anniversary. But the greatest thing of that meeting was, before they started the meeting, our friend Luis said, would everybody that was sponsored by Eric please stand up? And a few of us stood up. And they said, would everybody that's been sponsored by the people who just stood up please stand up? A bunch more people stood up. And they said, would everybody that's been sponsored by the people who just stood up, please stand up? And a bunch more people stood up. And they continued to do that until there was probably about 2 newcomers that were sitting down. Everybody else was That's what happens with each one of you that is sitting here. You know, I sat in a meeting, I was a little less than 3 months sober, and Eric never came to the Utopia group. You know, last time he was there, it was Artie's anniversary. He finished helping me through the steps, and he brought me into Utopia. He said, oh, I'm going to go to Utopia with you tonight. We went down there, we're sitting in a meeting, and this guy about 6 foot something, bigger than me, and no teeth, tattooed, really angry. Came time to share, and he started sharing, you people are full of shit, I can't stand all these, I don't want to be here. He was from the Creedmoor Rehab, because they came into our meeting, and just full of anger. And Eric looked at me and he said, after the meeting, go try to sponsor that guy. I looked at him like, are you nuts? And it wasn't because of the way he looked and that he was angry. He just clearly said he don't want it, and what do I got to offer him? I said to him, what do I got to offer him? I'm sober barely 3 months. And he opened up to a vision for you. And he said, Bart, what does it say there? You're just one man with this book in your hand, and you just tapped into a power greater than yourself. Go win his confidence. And you know what? I did. And I won his confidence. And I watched him sponsor a lot of people. And a lot of those people are still sober today. I don't know where he is. I pray all the time that he's still sober. But I don't know, because he kept relapsing. But he was sober for a few years and helped a lot of people before that. That's what goes on here. You know, great things. You know, I had a friend, you know, we help each other so much. You know, and I had a friend, Bill, who I used to stay at his house till 3 o'clock in the morning. You know, just talking all from early morning to the night, talking about God. And, you know, and one of the things he wanted more than anything was to see his sons get sober. You know, and I get to come to these meetings every once in a while and, you know, see that for Bill, that, you know, his son is getting sober. You know, and that's what we, you know, people say AA is a family, and I never believed it. You know what? AA is a family. You know, don't miss the boat. Get involved. I didn't stay sober the first time because AA was boring. You know, it was, because I wasn't doing anything in it. It's anything but boring now. You know, people are calling constantly. You're always asked to go somewhere, do something, talk to somebody. Life is anything but boring, and you get to enjoy it. You know, I just came back from Aruba with Tara scuba diving and just having a blast on an island. Everybody we met was talking about drinking. Didn't affect us a bit. You know, didn't affect us a bit. We just went, man, they drink a lot here. But we're having fun. We feel great. We're on that boat, jumping in that water, scuba diving, and no hangover, and it was great. You know, we really got to enjoy it. So, you know, I hope I gave somebody a little hope here tonight, because that's what this is all about. Hope. Thanks.